The BBC presents My Music, a radio panel game devised by Edward J. Mason and Tony Schreier. And here's Steve Race to introduce the teams.
Thank you. And welcome once again to the Commonwealth Institute in London and to our two versus two contestants, Ian Wallace and Dennis Norden, competing in musical knowledge against John Amis and Frank Muir. The first round this week is a junior edition, Children's Corner, you might call it. In fact, the first piece of music comes from Debussy's Children's Corner. But, Ian Wallace, what is the identity of the strange instrument which is playing it? I like it, actually. Ian, what's the instrument, the main instrument, we should say, perhaps?
This is what they call a synthesizer.
Yes, that's right. Can you put a name to it? An odd sort of name.
Moog.
That's right. The Moog synthesizer, spelt M-O-O-G. The Moog synthesizer. The Gollywog's Cakewalk was the piece. Comes from a very high-selling LP by Isao Tomita.
Can you sort of enlarge a little, Steve? I mean, I know that it's sort of obviously done in some electronic way. How is it, in fact, done?
You've already been too technical for me, actually. Frank, you know, do you?
The trouble is with electronic music is that it's precise. It's scientifically precise, and no music played by a human being is precise.
John wishes to speak on that subject.
This man in America who's done the Bach and the Monteverdi puts in mistakes by hand. He draws.
There's decadence for you.
Yes, that's right.
He draws them into the graph.
The only voice we haven't heard so far is that of Dennis Norden. So, here's a question for Dennis Norden. Dennis, a song about a baby of a kind, who is the singer?
You want to hold your baby on your knee, don't you, Daddy? You'll let her have a new annuity, won't you, Daddy? I'm sending you a present, too. It's going to be delivered, C-O-D. Gotta keep you happy to keep my pappy looking right at me.
I would say it's an unsuitable song for that sort of singer.
That's right.
I can't think of her name. The girl who sang in the American version of Guys and Dolls, not the film, a girl with a lovely voice who was a sort of soprano in the Broadway version of Guys and Dolls. Vivian Blaine. I can't remember her name.
No, you're way off, I'm afraid. But you were absolutely right when you said somebody whose voice did not suit the material. Would you say she was used to singing?
Well, she's a kind of soprano lady.
Yes, that's right, soprano. The film was called Something in the Wind.
That was Diana Durbin.
Yes, it was Diana Durbin. Half a mark. Diana Durbin it was, singing a rather obscure song in a fairly obscure film, Something in the Wind.
Donald O'Connor was in it, though. He was a good bit in it. The rest of it was... Well,
I think, Dennis, you often make the comment that, as between the first piece of music in the programme and the second, the standard goes down.
Yeah.
I think on this occasion it's reversed, it's gone up.
Yes. It's going up still further now for you, John Amis. What has this to do with small children?
Well, it sounds like a film composer having a rather nice time with a tune called Dies Irae, which is the Day of Wrath.
Yeah, well, no, not a film composer, certainly.
Well, then, perhaps an operatic composer?
No, not that either. No. Mm. There
what
was
else have we got? Ballet?
There was talk of him being at work on an opera, but he never made it.
Ah!
That didn't help you, surely, did it?
Yes, it does. Elgar.
Yes.
Very good hint, that was.
Yes, it was, as it happens. Rather subtle, yes. But a good
to me it wasn't. But
So, what has it to do with small children? Can you guess from there?
Well, he wrote lots of music about children.
But particularly.
There's the nursery suite.
And try again.
And there's the Wand of Youth.
Yes. It is, in fact, Fairies and Giants from Elgar's Wand of Youth Suite number 1. Tunes based on his own youthful sketches.
Thank you, Steve
and
Rafe.
Well, yes. I think if Dennis got half a mark, then you must get half a mark, I think, by the same token, by the same standard. Frank, the scene is a laundry. Mrs. Tiggywinkle's Laundry from the ballet music for Tales of Beatrix Potter. Can you name for your mark Beatrix Potter's rabbit and duck?
The duck was oh, Jemima, yes. Look at your uncle. Jemima Puddle Duck.
Thank you very much. Will do, yes. And the rabbit? Two to choose from, really.
Was Peter Rabbit.
Yes, or Benjamin Bunny would have done, but you prefer Peter Rabbit. Goody, goody gumdrops. And you've got a mark. And we move on to the next round with some technical questions about music. Ian, what's the advantage of movable dough? Movable dough. Where would you
probably
find that?
Quite useful if you're in the confectionery trade.
But, the banking business.
Yes. Yes. Or possibly if you were breeding at Whipsnade.
Or movable dough.
Presumably, this has something to do with something that I freely confess I know very little about. Mm. Dough must be something to do with the tonic sol
That's
fa.
That's right. The tonic note in tonic sol fa, yes.
A style of reading music which brings enormous benefit to many, but which I just never happened to learn.
Me too. Well, have a shot at movable dough, then.
I imagine that as dough is the start of a scale, the dough changes if you go into a different key.
Yes, the note dough always corresponds to the key note or the tonic, whatever key you happen to be in. So while you and I, Ian, are wrestling with seven sharps or something, the tonic sol fa singer is singing do, re, mi, fa, so quite happily, as if he were in the key of C.
It sounds as if I should pay it much more serious attention.
Worth trying.
Percy Grainger wrote a piece called The Immovable Dough.
Yes.
You've probably heard it, and there's this one note goes through it, and all the music moves around it all the time and modulates like mad, but still there's one note going on like an organ cipher.
It's not played by the same instrument all the time, is it?
No, I don't think so.
No.
It could be, because Percy Grainger said music is a habit like spitting.
Did he?
Dennis, he didn't write the refrain from spitting, was
it? Dennis, what is a ledger line? Ledger line.
Musically, you mean?
Well, yes.
Yes. Well, smartly giving Ian my pen, I would suggest that it's musically it would be a line that employs musicians, like the Cunard line. However,
Blue Starlight.
We're now back with the programme.
I must interrupt you.
He's playing Norton Crosses.
Most marvellous thing. I've just been watching Ian, and he has begun, in describing what a ledger line is, he's drawn an enormously long stave, he's put a clef on it, goodness knows how many sharps and flats. I'm waiting for him to add a ledger line. He's written everything
else. Well, the
ledger
line is in there somewhere. There's five of them.
There's some more coming up. He's just written some ledger lines.
Yes, now there's kind of eyebrows underneath.
That's right. That's right.
How do you manage a legible line?
When you go above and below.
Oh, I see. They're additional.
Eyebrows above or below the stave.
Yes.
A ledger line is an extra line drawn above or below the stave to accommodate further notes.
See, the tonic sol fa is still Greek to me, so if you know how far ahead that is.
John, a triplet is the word for three notes played in the time of two or in the time of four. What is the word for nine notes played in the time of eight?
No, no, Nanette.
It jolly nearly is, as a matter of fact. You're very nearly right. Have you? Do you know the real word for nine in the time of eight?
Come over the eight.
Try a, getting better all the time. Try a prefix and a suffix, put them together. Nine.
Nine. Non-octave.
Triplets, quadruplets.
Oh. Yeah. Triplets, quadruplets.
I can't give it to you, can I? Think. Half a mark, why not? It's a nonuplet. Nonuplet.
Wow.
I've got a tremendous bit of professional expertise.
You have?
That the tonic sol fa was originally do re mi fa so la ti at.
Yes.
That set, you'd be
that set the audience by the ears, didn't it? That has revolutionised the music industry, I can tell you. Meanwhile, Jock Frank, for your mark. What's a lure?
Eh?
What's a lure?
How do you mean?
Well,
it's lure. In what sense? What are we looking for?
Well, we're looking for what...
Is it a musical division? I mean...
Division, no.
And a division. It's not a timing thing.
It's a thing. Yes.
Instrument.
Yes. You're asking me the questions, aren't you? I thought I was asking you.
Well, it's the best form of defence is attack. It's a foreign instrument.
Truth.
It's the French for the.
Well.
The instrument.
I'm going to have to tell you, it's a prehistoric form of bronze trumpet found in Denmark and adjoining countries. Also a wooden trumpet like the Swiss Alpenhorn, a lure, L-U-R. No marks there, I'm afraid, but we move on to the next round, which is concerned with various examples of singing. Ian, just to introduce the subject, the last rose of summer, the harp that once, the minstrel boy, who wrote the words for all those songs?
Oh, the last rose of summer, which came in... Martha by Flotov, but he didn't write the word, no.
Minstrel Boy?
Thomas Moore.
Yes, Thomas Moore, yes. A friend of Byron, even to the extent of burning his memoirs. And in case anybody's interested, I think one of the most charming of all diarists. Tom Moore's diaries are absolutely delightful to read. Well, Tom Moore, 1779 to 1852. And Mark to you, and Dennis, on to you with one of the songs I mentioned, The Last Rose of Summer. Who is the singer here?
Tis the last rose of summer left blooming alone.
The next voice you'll hear will be the voice of Dennis Norton.
She rather specialises in songs about roses, I believe.
Ah, you got her.
She does a white rose, generally.
Yes, that's right.
Is it Nana Mouskouri?
Nana Mouskouri gets you a mark, yes.
The voice with the glasses on.
The voice with nice straight hair, too. Yeah. John Amis, thinking of a similar kind of music, what great favourite was the joint work of William Douglas and Lady John Scott? Or perhaps purists would like me to say the alleged work of William Douglas and Lady John Scott.
Are they characters in an opera?
Oh, no.
Are they real people?
Real people, yes, or were real people. And were responsible for a song. I'm going to have to
play it. Was William Douglas a reverend, William Douglas?
Don't think so, no. Let me play you a few bars of an Irish version of the song I was seeking. In it, John, but you recognise the singer, I trust.
Yes. It's John McCormack singing what in the common market we'll have to call Annie Camion.
Will we?
Too subtle.
Anne Laurie.
Annie Laurie, yes. Frank, back to Scotland, or the song anyway, is Scots. Who is the singer, though, in this?
By yon bonny bank kumbaya for Libre, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond, where me and my true love wherever walk together on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond.
Terrific favourite from earlier years, Frank. Yeah. Who was the singer? Yeah.
She's the one who sang Cool before anybody called it Cool, wasn't it?
Yes, really, she did. Yeah. Cool style.
Maxine Sullivan.
Maxine Sullivan, you remembered it. 1937, that record. Good for you, Mark. While we're on the subject of these favourite old songs, I discovered the other day, to my surprise, how much records cost in the early years of the century. Patti's record of Home Sweet Home. How much do you think it cost to buy in 1906?
Quite a lot.
Yes. John, any idea?
Patti was about 16 bob.
No?
15 or 16 shillings.
It was a pound. It cost a pound in 1906 to buy Patti's record of Home Sweet Home. So records went right down and then came, as we know, right up again. Interesting, I think. It's Chopin's famous A-flat Polonaise that opens this next round, though, with some masterly piano playing. Arthur Rubinstein. But what is he playing here, Ian?
Piano.
Well, it's not Peter and the Wolf.
No,
but something slightly similar, because it's also a sort of tale.
Yes,
it's the Love for Three Oranges of Prokofiev.
Yes, the March. That's right, from that one mark.
I heard Rubinstein, the Leek Festival horn, after he played a concerto, Chopin concerto, but people roared with applause, and he sat down and played that very polonaise. Mm. And at one point, he lifted his hand right up like that and went, "Boing!" Just as if he was firing off a cannon. I mean, he didn't hit any of the right notes.
Mm. An effect.
Terribly
sort
exciting.
Of a
that sort of thing. Lovely, yes. Dennis, your turn, and here's Rubinstein again. Dennis, Rubinstein could claim something in common with Glenda Jackson, John Wayne, and Tom and Jerry. What was it he could claim in common with them?
The only thing I know in common between Glenda Jackson and Tom and Jerry is Tom and Jerry got an Oscar.
That's right.
Yes. Yes, he did. That was quite interesting, that, because it wasn't... He did a film called Love of Life, or Love for Life.
That's it.
And it wasn't actually made as a cinema film. It was made for French television. And it was shown in America, and it got an Oscar.
L'amour de la vie, yes, that's right.
Also, I believe that tune he just played, now, I believe, was the singing tune of the Three Stooges films. Am I right?
I don't know that. Was it really?
For sure, I think so.
Now, all I do know is that Gregory Peck presented the Oscar to Rubinstein, and when somebody asked Gregory Peck, can Rubinstein really act, he said, good Lord, yes, he's a better actor than I am. Charming remark. John, here's Rubinstein again with some music suitable for a Punch and Judy show. John, who composed that?
Villa-Lobos.
Pardon?
Villa-Lobos.
Well, yes, I can't deny.
I stayed there.
Came in so quickly. Villa-Lobos, yes. What's it called?
Well, it's probably the Latin American version of Polichinelle.
Yes, Polichinelle. Elias Punchinello and Punch and Judy. Yes, Villa-Lobos composed it. Mark to you, and Frank, your turn. Once in a while, Rubinstein treats the piano as rather less than a friend. Listen. Thank you. you might call Rubinstein's arrangement of the ritual fire dance. Frank.
I defy you to ask me anything else.
Well done. It is another question, Frank. When an interviewer asked Rubinstein, "Do you practice a great deal?" what did he reply?
I am a doctor of music, not of medicine.
That's really genius, actually. In fact, I feel tempted to give you a mark for that. The interviewer said, "Do you practice a great deal?" And Rubinstein said, "No, thank God." And that was the beginning of the next question.
It was an interview or a recording of a previous interview with him on the radio where he was asked about this name of virtuoso of the piano, and he said something to the effect that he said, "I'm always very surprised at this word virtuoso, which presumably means that you are a practitioner of virtue. I never knew a virtuous concert pianist."
Too much touring, yeah. If you care to be clearing your respective throats, John and Ian, we'll move into the last round and the singing bit. Dennis, you first.
No, not for singing. No. Ian came out with the phrase I've been looking for through 10 series, a mode of utterance.
Well, for you, a mode of utterance in B-flat, Dennis. Debussy wrote a piece about the girl with the flaxen hair. I wonder, can you remember a song about another fair-haired girl, the one in this case who waltzed with Casey? I'll give this. You a... Pick your key, I'll find
you. I wait too politely, yes. I have a point to make about the clue. Casey would dance with the strawberry blonde and the band played on. He'd waltz across the floor with the girl he adored and the band played on. From now on, it's raw courage. It wasn't flaxen-haired. It's the thing that I've always wondered with this song. What colour is strawberry blonde?
Well, somebody tell us. Anybody? Any strawberry blondes in the audience?
Because the strawberry surely must either be red, green, or if you cut it open, sort of white. Slightly pink.
Thank you. Slightly pink. Right. Casey would waltz with a slightly pink blonde.
That's it.
Guess Dennis 2 marks. John, I've been wondering, can you sing us an advertising jingle for lavender, perhaps, or strawberries, or anything you like? An ad.
Well, there's a little jingle written round about the year 1600.
It would be, wouldn't it?
If I can find my countertenor voice, goes something like, "Fine necks for ladies, cheap choice, brave and new. Good penny words, but money cannot move. I keep a fair, but for the fair to view, a beggar may be liberal of love. Though all my wares be trash, the heart is true, the heart is true, the heart is true."
Move over, Della. Yes, well done, John.
And Shirley Temple.
Frank, in your best Poonar voice, can you sing the song of the gay old stager? Please.
Would you like a call? Bumpity bump, bump. Bumpity, 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 bump, as I go riding my charger. Bumpity, 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 bump, as proud as an Indian Rajah. Hear the girls declare, there's a gay old sager. Hey, hey, clear the way, here comes the galloping major.
Yes. Very, very. Dashed fine, that was, dashed fine.
Thank God.
It's almost time for us to say Narpoo, but not before we've had a closing song from Ian Wallace. Ian, a colleague of mine, distinguished himself on the radio by talking about songs with, as he put it, monosyllabic titles, like Unless and Until.
I do, actually, there's a monosyllabic title if in that case. Casey would dance with the strawberry blonde and the band played on.
On. On. Well, I thought, Ian, you might go, I suppose the word is duosyllabic, is it, with the second verse of Until. Would you? That's the verse beginning, "Oh, rose, bloom ever in my lonely heart."
Do you remember that riff?
We all sing.
Oh, rose bloom ever in my lonely heart. Oh, star, shine steadfast with your light divine. Bring on our song your melody divine. Life's crowned at last, and love is ever mine.
Ring on, O song, your melody of joy. And the joy at the end of this particular edition of My Music is all on my right. A victory by 2.5 marks for Ian Wallace and Dennis Norton. Goodbye.
Taking part in My Music were John Amis, Frank Muir, Dennis Norden, and Ian Wallace. The questions were compiled by our chairman, Steve Race, and the program was produced for the BBC by Tony Schreier.